We've gone a lot further with our thinking of what we're doing with regards to interoperability. Interoperability, of course, is basically around getting data from other systems. We're focusing not just on interoperability between Web3 systems, so between blockchains. We're also focusing on trying to have as safe as possible, as decentralized as possible, interoperability between Web3 and Web2. So what we've ultimately built is a layer one EVM blockchain smart contract layer that is optimized for data acquisition. The network is its own oracle.
You have just heard from Hugo Fillion, co-founder and chief executive officer of Flare Networks. Earlier in his career, Hugo was a commodity derivatives portfolio manager. When he got bored with traditional finance, he went on to study machine learning at University College London, where he met his two co-founders. So let us dive right in.
Here we are at the unofficial day 3 of the WebEx Asia conference with Hugo Fillion, a co-founder of Flare Networks.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
How was your conference week so far?
Yeah, very good. Very energetic, especially the first day. I was told the booth was very busy. It's pretty exciting to see how much energy there is here. We've had a great time.
Great time also in terms of making new business connections as well as maybe staffing up the team here.
New ones, consolidating or trying to improve old ones. And yeah, definitely looking to hire here.
You moved yourself from London to Dubai, eastward movement. Is it going to go any further than Dubai?
I think we're going to add more team members here. I am fairly ensconced in Dubai, some kind of mollusk.
We had a few guests recently that are based there, and they're all very positive about the ecosystem, while at the same time saying, I think Anton Gorlop said, it's a comparison to Zug and Crypto Valley, maybe 2016. You see where it's going. Not everything is there just yet, but it also gives the opportunity maybe to help shape it.
Dubai is doing incredibly well in attracting people who are fed up with the excessive complexity, the excessive regulation, or the lack of regulation in the West. And also, there's a feeling of hope in Dubai, there's a feeling of hope in Asia, there's a feeling of dynamism. If you go to London, if you go to New York, if you go to most places in the West, you feel the opposite. You feel a sense of despair. And that's not very conducive to building a business, because when you're building a business, or blockchain is not a business, but it is a collection of individuals from around the world that feel that they are trying to achieve something that hasn't been done before and that there's value to what they're trying to achieve. Even if you're doing just Bitcoin mining, right? You have to go and buy hardware and you have to buy energy. And you're doing that because you believe in the project. If you live in a society that doesn't believe in its future, it's very hard to have the mental fortitude to get up every day and try and build a better future. And that's why I think so many people are moving out of the West to other places.
What is your view on why that is? Is this simply the aging societies and stasis that devolves this is, or have we gotten too comfortable?
Sure, there are hundreds of factors. The two main ones I would say is, I'd say the social contract between the government and people seems to have broken down. You pay your tax, but you don't get healthcare. You pay your tax, but you don't get good schooling. You pay your tax, but you don't get security on the street. You get beaten up, stabbed, and robbed. The social contract doesn't exist. Those of us that believe that if they're going to pay tax, they should get something for it, obviously think, why would I stay here? The second thing is, we gave up trying to do new stuff in the 70s, probably, and just relied on financial innovation. And funnily enough, I actually feel that I see some parallels starting with that in crypto. It's one of the reasons why we are taking a different line in crypto. So when I say financial engineering, a lot of people in certain ecosystems, especially when it comes to staking, liquid staking and restaking, over excessively practicing financial engineering rather than focusing on use cases. That's what we did as a society in the West from the 70s onwards. I don't want to see that repeated in crypto. That's why we're building a network that is different to what we think has come before, that hopefully serves a greater purpose.
You have yourself the background in traditional finance. You have experienced that for many years. You went then back to school. Did you do this to learn something new and then figure out what you're going to do? Or did you have this blockchain theme in mind?
I certainly didn't have a blockchain theme. I'm incredibly bored in finance. I want to do something new. I want to meet some new people with different ideas. And that's where it went. Blockchain, crypto chimed with me because of my background. But my ideas have very much expanded since we first got into it. Most people in blockchain have a very strongly financial view of blockchain and that it's purely for finance. I disagree with that. I think it is useful, but I'm hoping there's many more use cases than just purely financial ones. I hope there are purely technological use cases too.
The origin journey of Flare, how has it evolved from the very first sketch on the whiteboard to what we have now?
We've been through a fair few number of iterations just in terms of our thinking, in terms of what we were trying to achieve. We started out as three people, myself and my two co-founders, Dr. Nairi Usha and Sean Rowan. We started just looking at what was going on in crypto, looking at consensus protocols primarily. Our first thought was, okay, let's build a new consensus protocol. We conceptualized one, we wrote up a white paper of one, but we never ended up deploying it. We're still very interested in consensus protocols, and we still think that actually there is probably mileage for further research into how to do consensus better. Everyone else is still going on about L2s and sharding, and that may well be the only way of scaling, but I'm not sure that all possible avenues of how to do a better layer one monolithic consensus, or even just a better consensus algorithm that then has L2s on top, have been exhausted. That's still an area of interest. But then we were like, okay, so we're not going to deploy this consensus algorithm. What is useful to do? And we started thinking about interoperability. We then move from, okay, interoperability is great. It's incredibly useful. We've built certain ways that Flare works for interoperability. In building that, we realized that we were building something much larger, which was quite fun to see and a little surprising. We were originally thinking, okay, how do we get information from other blockchains in order to be able to manage stuff across different blockchains? That's the basis of interoperability, is by being able to securely get data from another chain, respect that chain's consensus, keep security levels, so safety levels, decentralization levels, parallel to the other chains that you're working with. That's really the core of interoperability, and lots of people have different ideas about how to do interoperability. Unfortunately, what we've seen primarily in most products that have come to market is a desire to move very quickly and not really practice what we preach as an industry, which is decentralization and safety. Hence why the principal expression of interoperability, which has been bridges, has been multi-sig bridges that have caused pretty much the single largest loss in our industry as a cohort, close to $3 billion. There are some interoperability solutions that have merit. We think Flare is one of them, but we've gone a lot further with our thinking of what we're doing with regards to interoperability. Interoperability, of course, is basically around getting data from other systems. We're focusing not just on interoperability between Web3 systems, so between blockchains. We're also focusing on trying to have as safe as possible, as decentralized as possible, interoperability between Web3 and Web2. So what we've ultimately built is a layer one EVM blockchain smart contract layer that is optimized for data acquisition. The network is its own oracle. So it leverages the decentralized infrastructure of the network to get data from external systems, whether that's Web3 or Web2, onto the chain to come to consensus over that data in as secure manner as possible, as decentralized manner as possible. Those are the things that really matter to us, but then what matters really to the user is A, that it's secure, but as importantly, that it's scalable and that it's inexpensive. And this is where the optimization bit comes in. So we've spent really a very long time optimizing the data protocols, optimizing the way the data protocols interact with the network, such that we can acquire data at scale at the lowest possible cost relative to all other data solutions. We think that being able to do data at scale provable on chain opens up use cases that haven't been previously available. And that brings me back to my thesis. I think we're getting too far into financial engineering. because I don't think we're focusing on how to get people to build use cases that are relevant.
You touched upon the three corners of the trilemma: decentralization, the security, and then the scalability in terms of the data acquisition. But what about the scalability of transactions? Is there a trade-off that has to be made in order to allow better data acquisition that maybe from a transaction perspective you had to give up some throughput?
We do use throughput of the network for the data acquisition, but relative to, say, an Oracle that sits on top, data acquisition protocols are infinitely more scalable. That's what I mean by optimization. If you want to compare another L1 with an external data acquisition protocol, let's say Chainlink, there's no competition. If you were trying to supply the same amount of data through Chainlink onto another L1 versus through Flare, there's no competition.
In order to build really good performing DeFi applications, I also need quick access to data. And so you're expanding the range of things that can be built and maybe things that haven't been discovered yet. But as a default, if people just rebuilding what exists somewhere else, you have the better mousetrap even for traditional, quote-unquote, DeFi applications.
I suppose we don't have the better mousetrap because we don't have the value that sits on the network that other blockchains do. We have a system that allows for you to do stuff that's really cool, and if you just want to rebuild existing DeFi, you will be able to get data quickly and inexpensively. You won't need to pay gas fees for an Oracle. You won't need to use an Oracle's bespoke token to pay for that. You can do that all natively on Flare. And the prices come to the system in a manner that means that the DeFi application doesn't have to pay for them, at least if they don't need them at one block intervals. We are working on a secondary price protocol, theoretical basis for it, that will allow for an update of price every block. We are trying to determine whether that should have a fee associated with it, simply because it is quite a heavy protocol in terms of throughput. We haven't washed out how that should be structured yet, whether it should or shouldn't have a fee, is my principal question. We've built a substrate that we think is great. I certainly wouldn't say that there's an awfully long road to acquiring the value from other networks in order to simply allow people to just fork what already exists and operate it in a better way. Part of the solution to that is by offering tokens that don't really exist elsewhere, or at least in the same way. So we have two bridging protocols that we've built, principally to feed the network with value. The first is not technically a bridging protocol, it's actually a synthetic asset. We call it a delta neutral synthetic asset, and come on to why it's delta neutral. But we call it that because it's essentially a representation of a non-smart contract token like Bitcoin or Litecoin or XRP or Dogecoin. If you take Bitcoin and XRP together, they both sit in the top five. They're a very large percentage of the total overall crypto market. There really hasn't been too many trustless solutions to be able to represent those tokens on smart contract platforms. We have built a protocol called the F Assets, so it would be like F Bitcoin, F XRP, that is used as a multi-collateral base to be able to represent it, but then also makes it easy for the user to mint that token onto the network with their Bitcoin or XRP position. So they're moving their tokens to a person that is lending them collateral. That's why we call it delta neutral. That's the first bridge, and that's likely to be in testnet pretty soon. It's nice to have a trustless way to represent those assets. You don't need to trust us, it's not a multi-sig. You don't need to trust a custodian. You can just mint your assets through a protocol. That's always been our desire, to build a system that is trustless. Then we're building a smart contract token bridge for tokens like Ethereum, for tokens like ETH, anything that's from a smart contract network. That's called Layercake. Layercake's got some cool features. We've often at Flare thought too much about how do we make something trustless, how do we make something decentralized, and then we realized, okay, so our goal is to make it trustless and decentralized and safe. The market's goal is also to have something that adds value. Layercake's great because it is trustless, there is collateral behind your bridging event that provides a very high degree of safety. That's probably not the key feature of Layer Cake. The key feature of Layer Cake is that you can execute across different blockchains directly from your source blockchain without ever having to touch that other blockchain. And that's the key feature of Layer Cake, and we think that is going to be very useful, especially to funds and more power users in the space. Just give you an example. Bridge from Ethereum to another EVM network. You don't need to receive the tokens on that EVM network because you can bridge with call data. That call data can be a set of instructions as to what to do with your token. The entities that are operating the bridge, they handle your gas on the other side, and that's all rolled up in the fee that you pay for bridging. So depending on what set of instructions you're sending as you bridge, that will determine A, how much gas you're incurring on the other chain, and the bridge operator will set your fee correspondingly. But what that does mean is that you can execute anything you want across the other chain you're bridging to. In fact, you may be able to bridge to another chain, swap your token in a DEX for another token, and then immediately bridge that token back out to Ethereum or some set of instructions that you wish to make. Obviously, thinking about what are the predetermined instructions that we bake into the system, but it is essentially an open field.
That sounds like two new legal blocks in the toolkit that, as you said on the outset, open up possibilities that there surely will be people out there who are going to test this to the limit.
Hopefully. We think that if you can abstract away the complexity of blockchain, and this isn't a novel thought, like everyone knows this, that's why they're working on account abstraction, but this is almost like chain abstraction through a bridge. If the user doesn't really need to know or touch the other chain, that's quite useful in order to be able to transact. It probably extends to other areas beyond just value as well. We're thinking about how that bridge can be used to handle data across chains. Could be quite interesting.
Through what mechanism have you avoided the traditional build of a bridge?
Traditionally, bridges are built as a set of, and they call them validators, but they're not validators, really, they're nodes. And they will operate essentially multi-sig that signs in contracts across chains. It's like the traditional bridge structure. And then there's things like Layer Zero that has this simply message passing service. And the default example of Layer Zero is lacks decentralization. They say it can be decentralized, but you'd have to find yourself a decentralized oracle that's prepared to pass your message across chain. I'm not sure I know one that exists. You'd have to find a relayer as well that was decentralized. Otherwise, the idea with something like Layer Zero is essentially, I think there's three parties that would need to collude to have control over what's happening in that message passing protocol, and that's not good enough for us. The same goes with multisig. I don't care how big your multisig is, it's not decentralized. Perhaps there's some arguments that you could use something like Axelar with a validator network that is staked. That just gets to capital efficiency problems. You would need to have 3x the value of the messages you're passing in order to remain secure. That's an undesirable use of capital. We've thought about it for a very long time. Layer Cake uses, to be technically correct, it uses an optimistic bridging model. And we don't call it optimistic because we think it's substantially radically different from being optimistic, that it doesn't really fit well in that model. But basically, an action happens, it can then be challenged. The difference between us and, I suppose, prior optimistic models is the action that happens is pre-funded, pre-collateralized. I suppose to try and break it down, you have what we call a bandwidth operator for the bridge. Now, let's say that bandwidth operator is the only bandwidth operator in the bridge. And let's say the bridge is a USDC bridge. So that bandwidth operator has put in, let's say, 100 USDC. That means that bandwidth operator can sign in the contracts for 100 USDC. If they sign in one contract for 100 USDC, then they're no longer able to sign anymore. That's what we mean by bandwidth. The size of the bridge is the size of the collateral that has been put into the bridge. Then, to account for things like chain rollbacks, the bandwidth has a period, a time over which it cannot be reused. And in most cases, that's 6 hours, but it is variable depending on the characteristics of the chain that Layer Cake is connecting to. Obviously, the bandwidth operator can do whatever they want because they have that signing right. They've got their collateral risk, but they could sign that bridge amount over to themselves. Someone could deposit in a Layer Cake contract and the bandwidth operator might not honor their transaction. We then have this challenge process, which allows for proof of the bandwidth operator behaving maliciously, at which point, if that proof succeeds, the bandwidth operator's collateral, remember that's the maximum amount that they were able to take out of the system, can be taken and put back into the system such that the system's collateral is not impaired. That's the basics of Layer Cake. It's a very secure model. We're doing an audit with one of the most reputable auditors. We're also doing a theoretical audit of the theoretical basis of the model with a number of pretty fantastic academics. We think it's a great model. We think the ability to execute across chains will be very useful to people. We're in no rush to get it out because we really want it to be safe.
How do you get people to use this exceptional technology?
We're really lucky. We had a growth strategy that seems to have worked out pretty well. Given that our first product on the network is this F asset bridge, we decided to distribute the token to people that held XRP, a part of the token. In fact, there's an ongoing distribution. So if you hold Flare, there is an ongoing distribution for the next 30 months, which means it's essentially a bit like the early days of Bitcoin, whereby if you participate in the network, you hold the token, you'll end up with a reasonable share of the total token supply. We have a number of ways to bootstrap. The first way was with XRP. That got us a very large community. We probably have about 5 million token holders. We have about 300,000 addresses, but obviously pretty much every major exchange holds our token. We're not able to fully quantify how many people that represents, but it's a substantial amount of people. So that was a start. One of the reasons we chose XRP was that there's a very large amount of value there, but very little people can do with that value natively on the chain. So we thought it was a good idea to try and liberate that value so that it could be used. That also got us a nascent group of builders from which we have 100 Oracle data providers. Literally 100 entities have joined us in order to run infrastructure and contribute to the pricing and, well, the data mechanisms overall. We were surprised, actually, by the uptake of that. Then we got many builders from that. Now we think we're at the point where we need to branch out to other ecosystems. We have a grants mechanism through the foundation. We have a very small seed stage fund, again, through the foundation. And we are reaching out to builders across the ecosystem, across the whole space, to come to Flare, to engage with us. We're not looking for you to leave your native ecosystem. We're trying to make sure that Flare can serve ecosystems, not just itself.
Do you have a dependency for Ripple building new functionality that negatively impacts the usability of Flare or makes it obsolete because they're building things that you enable?
Yes, that would be a risk. No, it hasn't happened. They have a sidechain concept, but it's completely centralized. To me, that's just a non-starter. But we've also gone so far beyond that original concept of allowing XRP to be used on Flare. We are the only Layer 1 EVM platform that is optimized for data acquisition. That has a value way outside of serving XRP and Bitcoin and all of those kind of things. Serving all the networks, not just XRP and Bitcoin, but also Ethereum and the L2s. Layer Cake as a bridge will be very interesting between. We've got a large enough set of useful aspects that if one gets competed away, we're not really concerned for the validity of the network.
Yeah.
We're very interested at Flare in how do I build smart contracts with data? Can I prove that I made this tweet? Or can I prove this thing from social media? Can I prove that this data exists? Can I prove that I have done this task? Whether this task is maybe training a machine learning model.
It's very common back to the origin of all of this at UCL with your machine learning course. What can you imagine that makes sense for really high data volume that then takes the full advantage of the Flare network?
Yeah, you'd never really run a model or do anything with data directly on a blockchain. That's just not built for that. But you can do proofs of running a model. You can prove that a machine learning model is what someone says it is. You know, if I have a specification of a model, I can determine that I am actually using that model, not some other model. I can prove that I own some data and I can sell that data. I can use the network as a way to source data collaboratively between many different entities to create a useful data set. So I may have 10 parties that have partial data sets, or let's say I'm interested in some data set and there's 10 parties that essentially have subsets of that data set. That then allows me to get hold of that data by paying for it. And none of those parties need to know each other. It's quite an interesting concept to us. I might be able to provide an input to a model, again, executed off-chain, but have the output verified on-chain. And the fact that model is doing what it says it is, and that it's explainable. One of the things that appears to be of great value, and is, I think, of great value, is that a machine learning model is explainable, such that you can at least at some point determine whether it is creating a bias. We all know that would be a terrible thing for humanity if certain people were locked out of, let's say, financial products or jobs or education or whatever, because a machine learning model is creating a bias against that type of person. And one way to mediate that, one way to demonstrate, okay, my machine learning model, this is what it's doing. It's very hard to prove it's not showing a bias on chain. You can prove what the model is, which then allows people to then determine whether there's a bias or not. That's where machine learning and blockchain has a genuinely useful nexus. I'm not interested in just machine learning on blockchain because, like, it's a thing. We want to build something that's useful, that people use, and that is helpful. That's where we're overlooking the power of decentralization as an industry. We focus so much on how can I rehypothecate my token in 500 different ways. We're not focusing on how do I activate 10,000 or 20,000 data scientists, undergrad or postgrad or master's level data scientists that want to do a project in their spare time. Sure, you've got Kaggle, but that's just a very one-dimensional, one-way mechanism for a company to basically glean insights virtually for free, right? The prizes are so minimal compared to setting up a data scientist department. What we want to do is be able to actually allow those people to harness their skills. If you're thinking about what machine learning and blockchain could be, it's creating a workforce that is accessible globally without having to go and find them and source them and pay for hiring and validate even that person is good. That because you can prove the data on chain, you can prove that they can train a model. They have taken data, that model is trained, that it produces a certain error rate. It's like having an Amazon Mechanical Turk, but for something A, more interesting, and B, you're able to actually verify numerically, not just in a qualitative way, able to verify quantitatively that the people that say they can do this job can do it. And that's, I think, really interesting.
If you're talking about democratizing anything, keep it talking then about democratizing the data science space, because if you can decentralize the data acquisition.
SETI had a program years ago where they would use idle computational resources to go through their data and see if they could find a pattern that suggested there was alien life. That was a really nice way of crowdsourcing computational resources that they didn't have the ability, that they didn't have the money to build a data center for at that time. One of the big obstacles to machine learning is that at the moment it's substantially difficult to do machine learning outside of a Google, outside of a Tencent, outside of a major institution that has a stranglehold on data. If we leave one of the most important technologies to a few very large corporates, our future looks like every dystopian idea of the future. If you can crowdsource data, if you can crowdsource skills, if you can crowdsource If you can provide a verification substrate, then you can crowdsource it. And that has value, and I think is interesting, and I think is a potential way to take a bit of the power away from the very large companies, which is, to my mind, a desirable thing to do. Our take is that at least at a minimal level, a data scientist is going to be able to interact with the blockchain. Go for the low-hanging fruit, which is training and model interrogation. Flare is a data marketplace. I think it'll be interesting. I think that people will have data sets, and I do think there'll be ways to aggregate them and create more useful data sets. But I don't think it's going to be the primary use case of, at least for, not for a long time. At least not until someone comes out with a fantastic game as an app that is allowing people to also share their data in a secure way and get paid for it. That's what, in a way, Sam Altman's trying to do with WorldCoin, right? It's like you share your biometric data. Again, I think that's a very big ask. It wouldn't be the first place I would start if I'm trying to encourage people to share data personally. It's not the most intuitive thing that you would necessarily think about, is to get people to start interacting with their personal data in a way that is going to create value for everyone.
So if people now are interested in getting engaged, what's the best way to find out more about Flare and the community?
Flare.network is our website. It's just a front page. There's lots of links there as to each protocol. And there's a links to our doc site, which if you're interested in building on Flare is probably the place to start. Then obviously we're quite present on Twitter. We have a Telegram group, we have a Discord. We do weekly dev sessions on our Discord, a place where people with questions for our developers can go. Not necessarily questions about, is the token going to go up in price? Or do you have any major partnerships in the pipeline, but more actually technical questions? That's the overview of how you'd engage with us. Otherwise, our GitHub is probably a good place to go as well.
Do you have reference implementations?
We've got some reference implementations for the oracles. And of course, you know, all of the code's open source, apart from Layerkit, which is source available until we figure out how it gets monetized.
What's the importance of the Asian part of the ecosystem? How do you envision Flare to grow across Asia?
We're thinking about how to tackle that more radically than we have. We have a very sizable token holding community in Japan and in Korea. We are looking at how to scale up our presence and our, most importantly, our technical presence in Asia. One thing I'd say is that I'd certainly noticed that currently Asia lags in terms of building stuff that is native for Web3. If you look at a lot of the real development, it is coming out of Europe and India. India is, of course, in Asia, but we're talking specifically about this part of Asia. There seem to be hurdles here to building to the same kind of Web3 development that we see elsewhere. I'm not sure I understand that well what those hurdles are at this point. We're trying to figure that out so that we can encourage development. One of the areas that we differ from perhaps some of the other blockchains is that we are focused on DeFi because it is the lowest hanging fruit for us today. We do actually have options that are more regulatory compliant, like the machine learning aspect may play better in parts of Asia than building a DeFi protocol that potentially is not regulatory compliant. We provide options to developers that some of the other protocols, blockchains, can't provide.
That's good news for us in this part of Asia, because we're probably seeing you or your team here more often.
We are looking for a head of country for Japan and a head of country for Korea. If anyone's listening and you think that you're that person, please contact me.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you very much, Hugo.
Thank you.